You are listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Klintzenmeyer. My guest for episode 97 is Danny Seraphine, a founding member of the band Chicago, who played with them through 1990. You are right now listening to Take Me Back to Chicago, a song he wrote for Chicago 11 from 1977. We're going to talk about another one of his songs, Little One, from that same album, and then Street Player from Chicago 13, 1979. Most of his songwriting for the band was packed into the late 70s there. But we'll also look to Devil's Sweet, an instrumental he co-wrote from Chicago 7, 1974. And I want to point out that we also talk a lot about his 2011 book, Street Player, My Chicago Story, which makes clear he was really a key decision maker throughout his time in the band, that the first members who played together were him, guitarist Terry Kath, and saxophonist Walter Perizzator, whom he convinced to leave music school back in 1967 and start this supergroup, originally called Chicago Transit Authority, with all the best players they could find in town, including their full horn section and Bobby Lamb, who became their main songwriter for most of the early albums. But it was Danny who got Peter Cetera to join, and who later got Laudier de Oliveira, the Brazilian percussionist who recently passed away, who was present on the songs we're going to talk about today. Danny also got Bill Champlin, who eventually took over the role of the soul singer in the group, originally occupied by Terry Kath, who died tragically in 1978. Danny also got producer David Foster involved, and it was even his decision to get the Diane Warren songs on Chicago 19, which were their biggest hits at that point. Nonetheless, he was kicked out of the band after Chicago 19, reportedly for being too aggressive in asserting the business direction of the band and not spending enough time actually concentrating on the drums. So there's still a lot of bad blood about that. He retired from the music business for a while, but was eventually encouraged by guitar god Mark Bonilla to start something called California Transit Authority that plays from the Chicago repertoire as well as original songs. And they've released two albums, the first one in 2007, and we're going to hear something, The Real World, from their second album, Sacred Ground, 2013. For more information, please see DannySeraphine.com. For more about this podcast, visit NakedlyExaminedMusic.com. And if you enjoy what we're doing, please go to Patreon.com/NakedlyExaminedMusic. If you sign up there to support the podcast, you can get access to an ad-free feed that includes bonus content and show that you want this to continue. So I will have played a little bit of Take Me Back to Chicago, your biggest hit from Chicago 11, 1977. And we're going to get pretty quick to Little One from the same album. And I saw it reading your book that those two were sort of a pair. They were written within a month of each other. It's the same writing team, you and David Hawk Walensky.
Yes.
And sort of when you were getting into doing more lyrics, do you want to say a little about your emergence as a full-on songwriter, not just a drum solo thing or I'm writing an instrumental piece, but competing with the others in terms of a lyricist, concise song form?
I first got into writing lyrics pretty early on, not on a regular basis, but on the third album with Peter Cetera on a song called Low Down. And I got a taste of being one of the songwriters. And, you know, I liked it. I mean, I felt like I had a lot to contribute rhythmically and arrangement-wise. As far as Take Me Back to Chicago, those songs during that period of time were very inspired by events. Take Me Back to Chicago was written about a dear friend and associate. He was a drummer from a band called the Rovinkind in Chicago, who James William Gersio signed before he signed us, and he moved them out to Hollywood. They, in fact, lived in the house next door to us, and they were called Illinois Speed Press. So we became really good friends, and we hung out a lot, and obviously both being drummers and Italian, and it was a lot in common. He was a really wonderful person, and he was a really fine rock drummer. He always wanted to have the technique and do the swing stuff I did, but it wasn't in his wheelhouse, and he kind of tortured himself with it, which I told him not to. I told him, what you do really, really well. He said, oh, man, I want to be like you. I want to do some of those things, because he liked, you know, Buddy Rich and Gene Krupa and jazz guys. So Illinois Speed Press, we used to play clubs together in Chicago when they were the Roving Kind and we were the big thing. So there was a camaraderie there. But there was the difference was the Illinois Speed Press got out to Hollywood and partied like rock stars before they were rock stars. So consequently, they never had the success that they should have had. 6 days a week, we rehearsed 5-7 hours a day in our living room while they were just, we'd start and at noon or 1 o'clock, they'd be waking up from partying. So, you know, there was a thing where we made it and they didn't. But there wasn't a jealousy thing, but, you know, Fred and I kept that relationship. And then one day I got a call, and this was after we kind of made it. We were doing big auditoriums, and I'd gotten a call from a fellow Chicagoan, Marty Greb, who was Peter's bandmate and a well-known sideman. I got a call and Marty says, hey, Danny, Freddie's really sick. You should come and see him. And I said, okay, you know what? I said, I'm going to leave for a tour in 2 days and I'll come and see him when I get back. And I'll be gone only 2 weeks. It's a short tour. He said, Danny, you need to come see him now. And so I got the gist that, okay, he's really bad. And so I went to see him. He was in, you know, LA County Hospital. It wasn't a nice hospital. He was in a ward. He had tubes coming from him in every which way. Nobody knew exactly what he had. It could have been an early version of AIDS. He looked horrible. He had some sores on him, and he looked just horrible. And we talked, and we kind of cried. I cried, you know, because he was such a good guy. He was really one of those guys that was like a saint. You know what I mean? Never said a bad word about anybody. The most easygoing guy. The last thing I remember was the nurse was coming in and said, I've got, you know, he's got to go to the bathroom. I got to put him on a bedpan. And he said, please, Danny, you got to leave. I don't want you to see me this way. I want you to remember me the way I was. You know, that kind of stuck with me. I tearfully said goodbye. I hugged him. And then I went away on tour and we played a show and I got home and I, you know, unwound and went to bed. And about 4 a.m, I woke up from a dream and Fred had come to me and said, take me back to Chicago. And all of a sudden, I just woke up and I wrote literally all the lyrics right there in about 3-4 hours. Went back to sleep because I was so tired. Woke up the next day and found out that he had died around 4 a.m. in the morning. And so, you know, I believe in things like that. I really do. I believe there's much more to the eye than just black and white. Well, you die, you're gone. I believe he reached out to me. And so I wrote the song about that's written about Fred Pappalardo. Yes, there's some of me in that, of course, you know, because that when you say, you know, Street Corners and Tasty Freeze, well, you know, take me back to Chicago because hustling's not my style. L.A. was just a bit too tough. That's more about Fred, you know. L.A. was taking its toll on him, you know, in a sense of the competitive drive. And he wasn't a super competitive person, but a great person and a really fine drummer. I sent the lyrics to Hawk Walensky. Hawk was from Chicago. He was with a band called Banger Flying Circus, amazing prog rock band, and a band called Madura that Jimmy Garcia signed to Caribou Records. And so they lived up in Colorado on another ranch that Jim Garcia owned. And so we became really close. And I said, hey, you know, would you take these lyrics and maybe write some melody with it? And I got him the lyrics and he kept back to me. He said, those are really good. And he changed a few things and he came back with the changes. And what Hawk and I did is at my house in L.A., because he came, flew in and stayed with me. I had a studio. It was just him on piano, me on drums. We kind of came up with the arrangement, the feel, the 7-4 time, 5-4. I really loved the playing in odd time. So you hear almost everything I've written, there's odd time bars, especially Take Me Back. There's 7-4, 5-4, and then, of course, 4-4, you know, mixed together. So I always had in mind that Robert Lamb would sing it. I felt it was really right for his voice. And once we recorded it, Hawk said, hey, why don't we bring Shaka? Because Shaka was new into Rufus, you know. That was a new relationship for him. And Shaka was a young, she was like 20, 21. So Shaka came up to the ranch and sang all the backgrounds and did a rave at the end of the song with Terry Kath. And it just was magic.
So that started this partnership. So it looked like Little One was the next one that came out of that.
Yeah, Little One was in that same kind of time period of my life where I was just experiencing the highs and lows of superstardom, right? And my marriage had fallen apart and I was divorced. And we were going on a promotional tour to France. And I thought, you know, mate, this would be a great time to bring my daughter, Chrissy, because I know she was really hurting. My kids, Chrissy and Danielle, were both hurting with the divorce, but I couldn't bring them both. So I brought Chrissy along with me on the tour. And, you know, we slept in the same beds at the time in rooms that didn't have two beds. And for my daughter, at that time, she was probably 10 years old, 9 years old. I remember, you know, waking up really early in the morning one day, and there was a little crack in the curtains, and there was like a ray of light shining on her face. And God, it was eerie because it looked just like her mother. And I was hurting too, you know, because I was very confused and somewhat disillusioned in a sense that I should be as happy as you can imagine. And yet I felt, had this big empty feeling inside of me, even though I was making, you know, tons of money and experiencing enormous success. And I was very confused. And yet my family life, my marriage had fallen apart and I was empty. And so I wrote about that, you know, and I wrote about what it's like having to live the life of a musician and a famous one and being away all the time and the sacrifices and hoping that she understood and always knew that I loved her and always would be there for her no matter where I was. You know, if I was in China and she was in L.A. or Chicago, that I was always there and all she needed to do was call and I was always thinking about her. you know, Little One was another inspired song that I woke up, wrote the lyrics, and I fine-tuned them over a few days because as I got better at it, I started doing my own editing and sent it to Hawk. And, you know, we came up with a really beautiful arrangement. And again, when I heard this song, I said, this is for Terry to sing. Terry just jumped at the opportunity to sing it because it was reminded him of his daughter, Michelle, who was, you know, very young, a baby still. And so he was like, he said, yeah, I really want to sing this. This is, you know, it's a great song. I can really identify with it. And as it turned out, sadly and tragically, it was Terry's last vocal.
Lying here as the morning light shines in. Reflections from within. To look at your face takes me to a place that reminds me of the lovely lady I once loved. Thank you. flower you'll grow, little one. Someday you'll have your own, little one, and you will always be there. Oh,
you've got a suite here with the prelude and little one and the inner struggles of a man, Dominic Frontiere, I see doing orchestrations, and he wrote that inner struggles of a man. So it's really the prelude has itself a prelude, you know, another 2 minutes that are just going right into this. You know, was that a complete after the fact, the song is done, even just coming up with the prelude, where would that come in? Was that part of the original composition or did that get tacked on later?
The inner struggles of a man was my idea. Jimmy Guercio came up with the idea of contracting Dominic Frontiere. He did a wonderful job. And he originally came from a Donny Hathaway song. I'd have to go back and look at it. He had an orchestral piece setting up his song. I just thought about this. Inner Struggles of a Man was a really great heading for the song Little One, because it really was, that's what it was about.
So you got the lyric by itself. Was this, again, just like Take Me Back to Chicago, that you send it to Hawk and he more or less comes up with the melody and the main chord progression, or were you working together even at that stage of it?
After Take Me Back, we were working closer. I came up with the idea of the freeform intro. And I said, let's do, you know, with the mallets and stuff, lying here as the morning light shines in, with the flugelhorn, bluesy flugelhorn, you know, playing behind it. You know, those were my ideas. Obviously, I'm not a keyboard player, so Hawk came up with the chords and beautifully, you know, came up with the melody. And as far as the groove and the feel of the song, he'd have his keyboards and I'd have my drums in a room. And we'd have a little two-track or whatever. We'd record it, do these really cool kind of little demos so the band could hear. What ended up happening, other than Jimmy wrote the horns, Jimmy wrote a beautiful horn part. You know, it was very collaborative with Hawk. As far as Dominic Frontiere, I sat with him when he wrote it and then he kind of did a sketch of it and led him in different areas. It was basically inspired by what we had recorded.
Yeah, so it's not a question of, you know, the Phil Spector on Let It Be of, like, we've got a completed song and let's dress it up. Let's just, you know, send it to somebody who's orchestrating. You know, it sounds like it was much more interactive than that.
We needed strings, and I'd have to ask Jim Guercio if Dominic came in after we recorded it or if he was in from the beginning. I know one thing. I was there when the orchestra did it, and sitting right in the middle of the room, and it was beautiful. It was a 50-piece orchestra, and it was just gorgeous. Having them do the overture, Inner Struggles of a Man, and then play through the intro and then the head through the song, it was really beautiful.
So within Little One, it's based around Hawk's electric piano riff, and there he's got some, let me just even play about 35 seconds in, this transition thing, which I noticed did not make it to a live version recorded soon after this. Those little chimey clock transitions, which, you know, sound very eerie to me. Was that awkward to have, you know, you're basically bringing in a whole other, in a arguably keyboard-led band with a lot of the big songs. You'll have Bobby's piano being the main thing that sets, you know, Saturday in the Park, etc., to basically bring in a whole other keyboardist with a completely different style with a, you know, I don't know, the electric piano always makes me think of Bitches Brew, and which we hear a lot more of on the third song we're going to talk about, Devil Sweet. Even here, things like that that are breaking the tonality, say a little about how that influence added to the overall sound here.
Again, adding to the confusion, I'm pretty sure Lamb played keyboards on that.
Oh, okay.
It was an interpretation of Hawk's demo. Now, we may need to do a follow-up interview because I'll need to call Jim Gersio. I'll call Hawk. Robert and I aren't talking for some reason, so I can't call him. So I would call Hawk and say, did you play on the Little One record? He may very well have.
I'll point folks at the live version with Terry singing. I guess it was one of your last, you know, half dozen gigs with him that's on the internet. And I noticed it was missing that particular part. So I was thinking that, okay, that must be a Hawk thing. Yes, it says that Hawk played keyboards on both Take Me Back and Little One here.
Okay, makes sense. So that's probably why Lamb didn't, because it was Hawk that played on the record. And, you know, I didn't insist, please play that Rhodesy chime thing.
Even if something like this might start with you writing some lyrics, and even in the case of Take Me Back, where then Hawk came up with the main part, the fact that it's your song, the fact that your name is on it, seems to give a lot of room, more so than some of the songs that other folks wrote, to put big drum fills just to really think it through rhythmically.
We'll make it disappear.
We've got these very rhythmic chants, dun, 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 very punctuated, which as that then continues and you have like the outro of the song with this repeated Little One and just spiked with giant drum riffs every so often.
That was on the demo too. And I threw in the 7/4 bar. Dun, dun, then the turnaround being a 7/4 bar. You know, I always like doing stuff like that. I mean, that's why drummers, or quite often they're rhythmic, deserve writer's credit and compositions, because a lot of those things are truly important. And Hawk was very respectful. A lot of the inspiration came from me, but because I don't play a melodic instrument, Hawk was a great interpreter of what I wanted for the song. And then he's a phenomenal keyboardist. He added his touch to it as well. It was a great team. We've written quite a few really good songs that have stood the test of time. We haven't written in a long time. Maybe someday it'd be fun to kind of revisit that, try to do some more composing together, because we're still good friends. In fact, I'm going to see him in a couple of days.
Sure. Yeah. I was wondering about that dynamic. My very first project, I was playing with a keyboard player who had a sequencer, and I didn't have a sequencer. And so it was a lot of me humming things. I was playing rudimentary bass things and mostly vocal melodies in my head, and just working with somebody who can then translate that into, I mean, heck, even Paul McCartney, when he did his first orchestral stuff, had, you know, an actual orchestral arranger there for him to hum things. You know, he didn't just sit down with a bunch of staffs. It just having it be interactive and having the melodies come out of one's head instead of out of your hands.
Yeah, well, I mean, Jimmy Haskell, the string writer that did strings for If You Leave Me Now, Searching So Long, and other songs, confided in me once and said that my drum fills inspired, like in Searching So Long, he did those to kind of double my drum fills, you know? And I thought, wow, that's really cool, because I kind of thought so, because, you know, I could hear along with my drum fills, even the syncopation within my drum fills. It's really cool the way he did that. And it made me feel good that he told me that, because, you know, quite often drummers don't get credit for it. You'll play a basic track with just three guys, and then all of a sudden they put horns, and quite often they don't give the drummer credit for the inspiration of writing the syncopation to match what he's playing, you know, or inspired by what he's playing.
Let's play a little bit of the horn break, the percussion / horn break. We go to a double time, and then after just only eight measures, you've cut it back to halftime.
Yeah, it's a samba thing. You know, don't forget we had a Brazilian in the band. So,
yeah,
you know,
yes.
I'm about what's around me. We had Lagier, rest in peace. Beautiful man, beautiful player, playing the Pandera, which I've seen him play with Sergio Mendez. So that's the kind of creator I am, you know, in the sense of I'm a really much about my environment and using the elements around me. The flugelhorn and the samba thing I thought was perfect, you know. And Lee played a really beautiful solo, really melodic and beautiful. It couldn't have been any better. Still hasn't been, you know. I mean, I'd love to hear people cover that song because it's a beautiful song. Many people tell me it's inspiring to them. So hopefully someday somebody will cover it.
Let's hear at least one of the, in the outro, the big turnaround riffs I referred to. There are three or four of them. That transition, because that's such a great, that descending chord progression, you know, is just a key melodic part of the song and getting into that. And then you've got, you know, you do that a few more times.
That's Hawk's brilliance. I can't take, okay. I would never even pretend to take credit for that. We worked together and I would say, let's come up with something in this section. Let's lead it into the band. You know, we worked really well together and we wrote some brilliant things together that I'm really proud of. And I'm sorry we haven't done more. We did more. We did Street Player and
sure.
We did Show Me the Way and Aloha Mama, which was really freaking cool. Aloha Mama should have gotten more mileage than it did. Greatest Love on Earth. These are all coming to me now. Billy Joel thought The Greatest Love on Earth should have been a hit, should have been released as a single. And he's right.
Reading your book, you start talking about these two songs that you wrote pretty rapidly after you just hit it big with If You Leave Me Now, which, you know, established, okay, this is a band that we're famous for playing ballads. So I guess we should write, not exclusively, but to cultivate that audience, let's write more ballads. But you didn't like how that really didn't sound very jazzy at all, that you wanted more jazz influence. And so I was seeing Little One as maybe a way of reacting to that, really, and Take Me Back, that they're both, especially Little One, you know, basically ballads, but they've got more movement in them and just, you know, a lot more thicker chords, and they're jazz ballads, this one at least.
I don't think it was a rebellion against If You Leave Me Now. I just think it was a reflection of me and Hawk as musicians and what I brought to the band, you know, the jazz rock thing and the swing thing. We were both really musical people, but it was a way of interpreting those songs that I thought really were in the realm where Chicago would shine. The songs would shine having the band do it. You know, they really were good for the band, I thought. They got mileage. Take Me Back. It's kind of a backstory, but the record company, out of respect to Terry, tragic passing, released Little One when 75% of the stations in the country jumped on to Take Me Back. In their mind, well, we can always come back to Take Me Back. You know, that's a natural hit. It's already being played. Well, it backfired. Little One was really not a very big hit. They put a lot behind it. It wasn't a matter of that. But when they went back to Take Me Back, the records radio station said, we've already played it. So it was kind of a catch-22, and Take Me Back should have been a huge, huge hit. How much better could a song be, Take Me Back to Chicago, by a band called Chicago? It was really a great record. You know, Chaka Khan singing her butt off, and Terry and Robert. You know, it was a great vehicle for the band. But it never got to be the hit that it should have been because the record company released Little One, which, you know, how could I say nay on anything, because, you know, I loved Terry. It was a tragic loss. It was losing a brother, and he was singing a song that was, it was his last vocal, and it was a song that, to me, this day, maybe the best thing I've ever written. But, you know, it's hard to say, because I think they're all great, including Street Player.
Yeah, I always felt like having Terry in the band was like having Ray Charles in the band.
We didn't realize how good of a singer. I mean, we knew he was good, but when I listen to In the Country or Moving On and Brand New Love Affair, you realize what a great singer he was. I don't think he was used enough. Look at Make Me Smile. God, he hit it out of the park with that. It wasn't even written for him. Make Me Smile was written for Robert.
Let's take a break for a minute. Now, you may have forgotten, but Mother's Day is coming up. And for me, holidays like that always sneak up. And given that you have to come up with a gift every year, I have trouble figuring out what to get people. So I was excited to learn about Skylight, which thousands of moms have been calling the best gift ever. It is a photo frame you can email photos to anytime, anywhere. It sets up effortlessly in less than a minute. You just plug in, use the touchscreen to connect to your wireless network, and enjoy. You can preload your photos in it for a personalized gift. And everybody in your family can email photos to your mom right to the frame. They come up on the frame in seconds. So you can make this an ongoing gift and just send everything that's on your phone if you want. and it's interactive. If she likes the photos, she can click a little heart, and it lets the sender know that she loves a photo. Now, this is a black frame, looks like a real photo frame, adds a very nice touch to the home, and has a gorgeous 10-inch touchscreen. Now, Skylight is 100% satisfaction guaranteed. If your mom doesn't love it, if you don't love it, they'll offer you a full refund. I'm particularly excited just because it's so easy. Several years ago, I got my folks a digital photo frame that my sister and I filled with photos. And next time we visited, it had become a brick. Something went wrong. They didn't know how to use it. But Skylight Frame, with its ease of use, its guarantee, its constant updatability, that is not going to happen to you. Now, as a special Mother's Day offer, you can get $10 off your purchase of a Skylight Frame when you go to skylightframe.com and use offer code NEM. That's right. To get $10 off the purchase of a Skylight Frame, just go to skylightframe.com and enter offer code NEM. That's SKYLIGHTFARME.com, promo code NEM. Do you have a band? Well, you need a band website. And it should be better than my website, which is terrible, and it was created in 1997 using Netscape. Well, how about trying a site that provides websites that is built by musicians for musicians, BandZoogle. BandZoogle is an all-in-one platform that makes it easy to build a beautiful website for your music. They power the websites of tens of thousands of musicians around the world, from weekend warriors to Grammy winners. So everything you need is built in. They provide hosting. They provide a custom domain name. You can pick from a bunch of very cool design templates and customize them to your whim. They've got built-in tools to sell your music and merchandise commission-free. It includes mailing list tools to grow your fan list and send newsletters. It integrates with your existing social media sites, where you can pull in content from Twitter, SoundCloud, other places. And they've got a musician-friendly support team that provides live support for you 7 days a week. Nakedly Examined Music podcast listeners can go to BandZoogle.com and try it for free for 30 days. Use the promo code NEM to get 15% off the first year of any subscription. Plans start at just $8.29 a month. So go to BandZoogle.com to start your 30-day trial and be sure to use the promo code NEM to get 15% off that first year. That's BandZoogle.com, promo code NEM. Get that website up today so you'll look more professional than me, for crying out loud. Well, let's move forward to Street Player. I know this appeared later on Chicago 13, 1979, but had already appeared on Hawk's album with Rufus in 1978. When exactly was this written? Was this all kind of in the same batch of songs as Little One?
76, 77. I was in Europe and had come off on the heels of writing Little One, Take Me Back. That's my story. And, you know, I wasn't crazy about the job Rufus did on it. I just don't think it turned out as good as it should have been. So it was kind of sitting on a shelf. And we were in the midst of doing Chicago 13 with Phil Ramone. And the Carmine Appice, Rod Stewart song, Do You Think I'm Sexy, was really happening. I still think that's a great record. It's a disco song, disco rock record, right? I thought, you know, I talked to Phil Ramone and I played him our original demo of Street Player, Hawks and Mine. And I said, let's do the greatest disco record of all time, you know, musically. You know, Lauerto was a friend of Laugier's and myself. So we'd have Lauerto on percussion along with Laugier. Unless we could have Maynard Ferguson play the trumpet solo. And Peter just sang it butt off. And Panko, tremendous horn arrangement. Disco did not have the connotation of being good musicianship. And even though there were great musicians who played on them and singers that played on disco records. And Phil bid on it hook, line, and sinker and ran with it, one of the greatest producers of all time. And we created the old-fashioned drum loop where we recorded four bars of drums to a click, right? And me playing the groove, put it onto a two-track and ran it around a music stand and then recorded it onto a stereo on the 24-track for 7 minutes or whatever it was. And then we started overdubbing. We recorded it like a disco record, you know, in sections. And it came out beautifully. I was really proud of it. I thought, God, this is going to be. And the record company was just freaked out. They loved it. They put all kinds of money. They made this stupid video. If you ever saw the video for it, they spent stupid amounts of money on it. It was the early days of video. And, you know, I'm thinking, I'm actually practicing my Grammy speech in the closet, right? I'm so ahead of myself, right? Thinking, wow, this is it. I finally have arrived. I mean, I've written some really great songs, and this is going to be my statement. This is going to be my tour de force, my chance of getting recognized as a writer. And the record company thought so too. They're putting, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars behind it. And this is like, boom. And lo and behold, a disc jockey in Chicago organizes a disco demolition. His name is Steve Dahl. Now, we're friends. And they did 50,000 people went to Comiskey Park, White Sox ballpark, who's been since demolished, and brought their most hated disco record, to be burned in effigy. And lo and behold, Street Player was on the top of the pile. And it got all kinds of press, TV, and it just, the record company just, oh my God. So I went from practicing my Grammy speech to like, I've just been slammed into the dirt, you know, boom. It was probably God saying, you got ahead of yourself. It is a great piece of music. And ironically, so 10 years, 11 years later, after I was fired from the band and I'm hiding out in Colorado, just not wanting anything to do with the music industry, really, or playing drums. And I got a studio I wanted to produce and manage. And I get a call from this Englishman with a record company. I think it was EMI Records in England. And he says, Danny, we've sampled your song Street Player, and it's been released in Europe, and it's breaking out in all the dance clubs. And they'd called Hawk, and Hawk had verbally agreed to sell the rights for $1,500. And the guy says, Danny, are you going to play along? Are you going to be a good guy and work with us on this and sell the rights for it? I said, you'll hear from my attorney. And so I put this gal who represented me as far as my copyrights. Anyways, we had them by the short hairs because they went and released it without our permission. So Hawk got a third of the writing. I got a third. And the guy who sampled it and created this whole, and he called it the bomb. And I thought, why did he call it the bomb? And then I said, oh, of course, it was the biggest bomb of Chicago's career. What ended up happening is it ended up being the ASCAP dance record of the year. I mean, it was hugely successful. Hawk and I made a lot of money. And it was a time when it really needed it. For some reason, the Chicago royalties had really gone into the tank. And it really saved our asses for our 4, 5, 6 years. And because the amount of money, it's not from sales so much, but performance and ASCAP money. It was being played in every club in Europe. And then it came over here. It was like God's way of saying, you know what? You wrote a great song then, and you were just getting on your high horse. You needed to be knocked down, but this is your reward for this great song that you and Hawk wrote. And, you know, I just was really grateful because I really needed it, you know. And not only financially, but identity-wise, I was, you know, in a funk. I was really trying to escape. I was a hermit. I was hiding out. It was kind of like poetic justice. I hate to use the cliche, but it's true.
You were saying often the drummer doesn't get credit for some of the arrangement things that are put in, but you're saying this initial ba 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 ba, like the initial melody is just a Jimmy overdub. Then, in other words, arranging the horns actually means coming up with the horn melodies.
Those were synth lines.
So it was part of the song.
Jimmy's horn arrangement is beautiful. The jazz thing in the middle of the breakdown.
Yeah.
Jimmy's arrangement is brilliant. Some of it is a hybrid of Hawk's keyboard synth part. You know, but that's okay. I mean, I used to sit with Jimmy when he arranged the songs, and I would kind of say, look, please, I'm not crazy about that part. And I pointed out that I really, really liked that part. And he kind of voiced it with horns. Not taking anything away from Jimmy, what he did on that. It's a brilliant horn arrangement, and he deserves the credit for that. You know, time marches on, right? I'm still in Colorado, and until I moved back to L.A. in 2001. And lo and behold, I get a call from the lady who handles my copyrights, and she said, there's an artist, hip-hop artist by the name of Pitbull, that wants to release, he sampled Street Player and wants to release it, and he wants to send it to you for your approval. And I said, tell him yes, right? I don't even need to hear it. I mean, it was already a big hit. So lo and behold, the Pitbull one was even bigger than the Buckethead one. Now, we didn't, Hawk and I, it's a sample of a sample, because it was an Italian artist that had sampled Street Player. So it was the gift that kept giving. And I again looked up in the air and said, thank you. And, you know, it was a God's way of rewarding Hawk and I for this great song that we wrote that we really didn't get the credit that it deserved. And it's still being sampled. There's another version, I think, coming out. So Street Player, it's ironic. It was my biggest and the band's biggest flop, and it's turned around and being the biggest hit.
The newer versions, the Pitbull one, I mean, works like I would understand a sample to work, that you've got, you know, a rhythmic element, but it's still an independent song that's written over it. Whereas the Bomb, yeah, is really just the song sliced into bits. Like, looking on the Wikipedia description of the Bomb, it says, well, you know, the horns and the vocals are from the original, but it sounds like everything is from the original. It sounds like, no, it's exactly the rhythmic track that you had. I don't know if he did anything to make the snares harder.
I mean, I think that they're using some of the drum groove, even in the Pitbull one. It sounds like, boom, ka-tack, boom, boom.
Uh-huh.
Sounds like, so it sounds like it's from the breakdown. I'd have to ask the original, and I met them because the Pitbull one also won an ASCAP award, right? So Street Player has been, you know, thank God for it. It's really helped me survive, and even though at times, even though I've been unemployed for 30 years almost.
The lyrics, I remember when I heard this when I was 14 years old and kind of thought, like, it's very nice to hear, you know, actually reading your book, that this was autobiographical, that this is not just some weird pose, like, oh, somebody came up with this, I'm so cool, I'm a street player. But no, this actually literally happened to you as described here, that you were in gangs and having fights and hanging out in pool halls, and music saved you from that. So,
yeah, that's what it's about. Now, the word Street Player was a band, it's ironic, but it's a band that I produced in Chicago, out of Chicago, and they were excellent. Just never made it. It was one of my projects that kind of fell. In fact, the story behind that is they were, A&M Records almost signed them, but instead of signing them, they signed Styx. They were, Styx is great. I love Styx. And I was always like, you know, a big fan of theirs. A&M was the most creative of all the labels, and they gave you the most creative license. And I really wanted to do something with them. And I was really disappointed. I remember when they passed on Street Player. But, you know, Street Player was a great band. So I loved the name Street Player. I always related to it. I felt like I'm a street player. You know, that's me. And so I got the name for the song from the band that I once produced, and then just elaborated on using my life as the model. I'm a street player, and I've seen it all. Hitmen, thieves, and many a brawl. But as you can see, I still stand tall. That's about me. I'm a street player. There was such a small space and time, I never knew that I would find a musical path for all to see, anxiety into ecstasy. You know, that's kind of how I think. And I think that hip-hop artists, and I think people that from the street, and I think in general, where they use their demons, right, to kind of create something beautiful. That's what that says.
That line, anxiety to ecstasy, just including the word anxiety in a disco song. Like, I cannot think of another example.
I remember when we finished it, we took it to Studio 54 and they played it there. And the record company was so hyped about it. They were ecstatic. They thought they had lightning in a bottle. And, you know, so did I, but, you know, shit.
So it's interesting that the Bomb version went with the main groove, the main chorus groove, the main verse groove. But the part we were just referring to, is where you actually start playing straight on disco. And that was, you know, excluded from the bomb, but that's like the part where you're actually doing the, you know, doing the every other, the half note on, and it's got the boomba, 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 you know, disco bass. He's going into this weird Barry Gibb.
Such a small space of time.
That just for three lines. And then with the anxiety to ecstasy going back to a more regular full voice.
Well, don't forget, we had just rubbed elbows with the Bee Gees, and I'm the one who had to lean on him. He did not want to do that. And in fact, today he probably still hates me for making him do that. When I used to go see him with his other band, I'd heard him sing. There was another falsetto thing. I'd heard him sing in clubs, so I knew he could do it. But that's a fantastic vocal. I mean, you know, his vocal in Street Player is just... Whew. Peter's an amazing singer. He still is. He doesn't have the range he used to have, but he's still an amazing singer.
Since we're talking about that, I mean, is it similarly with Aloha Mama and the fact that he is singing in a different register and felt the need to put a different name in the credits as if this was not him singing?
No, that was Peter's idea. I mean, that shows how great of a singer he is. He changed the whole character of his voice and pulls it off, you know, to make it gruffier and funkier. Peter really liked singing Aloha Mama. When he heard the demo, he said, I want to sing this. This is something I can dig into. And that's a good record too, Aloha Mama. You know, I think that's Aloha Mama's 13 as well, or is it? I think it is. Is it?
The first song on side one and side two of this record with those two songs. So crazy.
You know, I was kind of the hot writer for a little while, for a minute in the band. Aloha Mama is a great, really cool record, the halftime shuffle, and I really leaned on Jimmy. We really nailed it with the New Orleans horn vibe, you know, Dixielandish. It was really cool.
And you said having Maynard Ferguson on this, that was just something planned from the beginning. It wasn't that, like, we're trying to do a trumpet solo and I don't like what Lee is doing or something. No, it's just planned.
No. I think it was planned from the beginning because I wanted it to be a tour de force. And we contacted Maynard Ferguson and he came into the studio and he didn't want to get paid. And I said, well, what can I do for you? He said, well, I just want you to overdub some drums on a song of mine since your drum set is set up. And we were recording it, right? We were recording overdubs. Maynard Ferguson did the solo, fantastic solo, did some ad libs at the end, as you can hear. After the session, he said, I just want you to play some fills on a song, but you'll need your whole drum set. So he said, he had me, it was the Rocky theme that he did, which was actually a big hit, his version of the Rocky theme. And I remember this because it was one of the scariest things that I've ever done in my life and hardest. So I'm listening in the headphones and he's saying, oh, just do some fills. And he said, play along with it. Let's just hear you. And he took I'm going to take the other drums out because for some reason, the drummer had done it was horrible. The drums sounded like paper boxes. They didn't do it to a click. The horns were in one place, time-wise. The bass and the rhythm section were in the other. The singers were in it was the scariest. So we were playing along, and I'm about a third of the way through the song, and I break down and completely fall off the cliff with this. And I say to them, you know, if I were you guys, I would keep the original drums. I could certainly do something. They said, well, we've already erased the original drums.
Just right then.
Let me just tell you that we started at about 11 p.m. and finished at 7 a.m. And I finally got it. If you listen to the record, it works. But I would have to take sections and play to, say, the bass player. And then I'd have to stop. They'd punch me in, right? Because I got to be pretty good at punching in an analog. Somehow we made it work. And then I'd follow the strings. Or I'd go with the vocal. I would go with whatever was dominant in the track that created a glue that actually worked. But I want to tell you, it was really scary because I thought, oh, my God, that's full orchestra. That's probably a $50,000 session, and they're counting on me to pull it together. But I did it. I wish I'd done more session work and played on more people's records, but I was so stylized that people didn't realize I could play straight rock. You know, I could play jazz, and I could play other things. But that's something that I'm actually pretty proud of. I haven't heard it in a long time.
I noticed on the expanded, on the remastered edition of the album, there's a dance mix of the song, which strangely is slightly slower. In other words, it's like a half step, or maybe not exactly a half step, lower. Like as if somebody said, this is not optimized for dance the way you recorded it. His singing sounds weird enough in the first place that having it, I don't know if it was slightly sped up, that he's a little chipmunky on the release version.
I don't think so. You know, it's been a long time. That was Tony Bon Jovi. I think he's Bon Jovi's uncle.
Ah. You know,
the guys that he used to own the recording studio called Power Station, which was really famous in New York. He might even still be there, but he was a famous remix engineer, and he did a great job. I loved his mix, but I didn't realize it was slower.
Just if you play the beginning of both of them, you'll hear there's some pitch difference.
I don't think they had Pro Tools in that day.
It's much more common on analog, I think, because usually you had the knob there that you could just slow the damn thing down a little bit. And that was, I did that so much more when I was, you know, working a analog four track, you know, doing the various Beatles kind of vocals, or like everything sounds better a little faster than you recorded it.
I remember hearing a horror story about Billy Joel's first producer doing that to his record. And of course he freaked out because they wanted him to have a higher voice, so they sped it up. He literally bought his way out of the contract. I mean, it cost him a lot of money over many years. But I remember hearing about that and thinking, I always felt like if anybody messed with your music, I was pissed at Clive Davis when he edited Make Me Smile, until our manager, Larry Fitzgerald, told me, Danny, I mean, we hadn't had a real hit song yet. He said it's being played by, you know, 90% of the AM stations in the country. And then my next words was, can I go buy a Mercedes? And he said, yes. And literally the next day, I went to buy a Mercedes with Howard Kaufman to negotiate for me.
I just want to play a little bit of this complete breakdown into just percussion. So that goes on, and then that cool horn part comes in that you were referring to. Do you want to say a little about, you know, I see you also had Erto, the extra percussionist, who actually played on Bitches Brew, you know, was in Miles Davis's band during that period. I had not made that connection that he's in Weather Report. You got a lot of layers going on there. Do you want to say a little about how that came together? Was it really just start another track? Let's do some stuff, you know, or was there some more plan to it?
Well, let me put it to you this way. You know, there's no digital percussion there. So it was a table full of Brazilian percussion, and you had three of us playing ad-libbing. And, you know, of course, we'd do another track. But a lot of that is live. Mm-hmm. It's two guys, me chiming in, playing some of those tempo blocks. And there were some passes. Don't forget, it was all analog, so it wasn't unlimited tracks. You know, it was probably done on a couple of passes. But you're talking about, that's the beauty of that part. It's spontaneous. That's Ayerto and Laugier, two of the greatest percussionists of all time, you know. And then me chiming in, playing some stuff. I can't tell you what I remember playing it up, but because we were all like going in there with them. We were walking. It was a long table, probably a 10-foot table of percussion on stereo microphones, right? And we're walking around playing stuff, you know, with headphones on. It was too bad we didn't video it.
Just that clapping part.
That was Phil Ramone's idea. That was after the fact.
Oh, that was after the fact, because it really provides some structure, the fact that you've got this very disco thing. You know, it sounds like it could be freak out.
It's a disco-y idea, and that was Phil's idea, you mm-hmm. know, because Phil's the producer, got a great mind, he knows what we're trying to go after, the market. As far as the claps, when did it come? It's quite possible that it came early on. I don't remember.
Sure.
How many, let's see, it was recorded in 78, right? Was it, no, 79.
79 released, yeah.
Every night release, it was recorded after Terry died. Terry died in 78.
May to June 79 recorded, yeah. Yep.
So Donnie Dickus was in the band.
Yeah, speaking of him, so you got a pretty active solo. It's
That's
actually the dance mix version turns him up quite a bit, turns more reverb on him so you could hear clear what he's doing. But it's actually a very Terry-like solo. Again, would that just be kind of fill some space, Donnie, do what you want? Or was there more definite direction?
Well, there was direction. We definitely wanted a solo coming out. And, you know, it wasn't going to be a full-on solo, but it was more of a riff solo. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's always direction. And it's with me and with Phil and anybody else that was in the control room, you know, that, you know, wanted to be there. It was a collaborative thing. I think we recorded it at Le Studio in outside of Montreal. The percussion thing was done in L.A. It had to be done in L.A., I would think. Mm-hmm. I don't think Airto was in, would have been in Montreal. Unless he was in Montreal performing and we heard he was in and we said, hey, let's get Airto in on this, you know. That's the way things were done in those days, you know, quite often. People happened to be like, let's bring Shaka up to the ranch and do the backgrounds. Cause, and, you know, she's from Chicago and you know, loved the band and was happy to come in and contribute. So collaboration is a powerful, powerful thing. And that, you really hear that on that percussion break because it's pure Airto and Laugier and then myself.
All right, so I wanted to have three songs here that had very different ways of writing, and Little One seems like it's more typical of the stuff that you that even did subsequently that you did for Chicago 13, 14. But I wanted to look back to Devil's Suite from Chicago 7, 1974. So, naturally, going chronologically, we should have put this first, but I didn't want to scare people with a 10-minute instrumental as the first song. So we don't have to talk through this in great depth, but let's just talk about the fundamentally different, seemingly different way of writing here. And this is the only one that I think you have down as co-writing with Walter Perezader.
No, we did two. We did Air, and those were Walter's. It was written quite a few years before it was actually recorded on Chicago 7. So chronologically, I was living in Encino. It was probably 1974, 73.
I know it was released in 74, recorded August to December 73.
So, but it was recorded, it might have been 72. Walter and I kind of wanted to have a more of a say-so. We got together at my garage and jammed. So it was him on flute and soprano sax. And it was wild how we came up with Devil Suite and came up with that lullaby-ish, you know, horn line, right? In Devil Suite. In the intro, it was like an Alvin Jones, Tony Williams kind of, and Joe, I was studying with Joe Jones, Papa Joe Jones in New York, so I was really into the bebop. It was the result of that exploration of bebop that we wrote Devil Suite while doing, you know, the soprano. It was kind of collaborative and we kind of played off one another and there were bits and pieces of it. And then we put it together. It was really amazing how we put that full song together with the brush solo into the Tony Williams kind of, and that was Chicago at its best in the sense of the collaboration of the players developing the song. Because we did that quite often in beginnings. We did that on a lot of songs, you know, Robert Lamb songs, where they brought in a sketch and then we wrote the book. You know, we wrote from that sketch, we wrote the story. And that's kind of what happened with Devil's Suite. And Air. Air was, again, odd time 7-4, starting out with 7-4. But the demo was me playing congas against it. That crazy, you know, it was Walt and I came up with that. You know, I don't even know if I could play it today. And I've talked to other musicians, the guys that were in the Tonight Show band, the drummer Smitty and the guitarist who was the leader of the band. It was like they played that song. I mean, they actually played it and it was cool. It was just us stretching out. And you got to give Jimmy Gersio, he had a lot of balls putting that on a pop album. And the band, you know, you're talking about two straight-ahead jazzy songs put on an album that also had hit songs on it. That was really the beauty of Chicago in those days. You know, I mean, we really stretched it. We weren't afraid to take chances. And you know, we weren't always recognized for that. You know, people might have said, oh, they're biting off more. I don't remember what the reviews on it were, whether they were favorable. They should have been because they were great pieces of music and inspired. You know, the Devil Suite is a really complicated, beautiful piece of music. And as is Air and Prelude to Air. Give Jimmy Gersio credit. He put it out there, you know, as almost, it was one side of an album, if I remember correctly.
Right. To the fact that it's a double album, I think you can get away with a lot more. I was thinking of Chicago 11 as a double or at least as your suite as having the same structure. But no, the whole thing between Inner Struggles of Man and Little One and Prelude to Little One is still only less than 10 minutes, whereas this thing is 10 minutes by itself. Well, let's play it. this really sounds like you guys had been listening to Bitches Brew and that kind of stuff, like, you know, so open and free. And I did actually find lead sheets of this online as if to buy if you want your school jazz band or your to play this song. So that's great that it's gotten to that point.
Well, good luck. I don't even know. I can play it anymore. I'd have to woodshed like crazy. And maybe someday I will before I unplug, you know. I may relearn it and perform it with a jazz band, with a quartet or something.
But it's a nice mix of arranged things. I mean, the main... as you were saying, with some nice articulations just right there in the head. But then you break it up with these solo sections that, of course, you know, a jazz band is going to do what they want to do, you know, do their version of that. They're not going to be learning your solos. And just the whole latter part of the song that I'm not sure why this works to have this, you know, that's the turnaround riff.
In the turnaround riff in the solos, right?
Yes, you just solo for a while, and then at some point everybody goes, dun, 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 and then there's more soloing, and you do that about five times.
Well, let me put it this way. It's a set number of bars.
Okay.
It just doesn't always end up being a set number of bars. But there's a couple that are like, they're minor train wrecks, but it's actually, I think it's the 10th bar. But it is like a true jazz solo by the true masters. You know, they're soloing. And then boom, there's a set number, bow down, down, down. It was a wonderful way to break up a drum solo and to kind of set it up to build and build and build. So it's a great piece of music that I'll always be proud of. And I'm really, really grateful to Jim Guercio that he had the courage to put it on a pop record. It moved people. I think we needed to remind people musically how good the band was, because we'd gotten labeled as a hit-making band and selling out and this and that. This was a show that, yeah, we can still do it. We still got chops. There's still strong improvisational skills in the band, and it showed in those two songs especially.
Well, it's good that the music industry was as it was. You know, you're still in prog rock era that you could do that, whereas it seems like if after Chicago 14 you decided to let's do something more symphonic, and well, you tell me, certainly with the labels that you were dealing with, that was not what was... desired. But yeah, certainly there are lots of bands that still kind of make a decision like, well, I guess Chicago did that later with Stone of Sisyphus. We're going to back off our expectations. We're not going to do an album of ballads. We're going to do this album of things that, you know, reflects on, and then the label wouldn't even release it. And it was out of commission for a decade or something.
That was their karma for what they did. No, I've never even heard the Stone of Sisyphus. And I think, you know, it's a really tough name. It sounds like, kind of rhymes with syphilis, you know. I've heard that it's a good record. Someday I should step back and listen to it. But it was really kind of painful for me because that was the record that they were, you know, and all the shit went down with me. They finally released it. Is it good or not? Someday I might listen to it with an open mind. But it was a very painful thing for me to listen to because that was kind of on the heels of my demise, you know, in the band.
I had forgotten it was quite that close after you left that they were working on it.
I really believe in good karma and bad karma. You do bad things to people, it's going to come back to you eventually. And, you know, sometimes it's like John Lennon once said, instant karma.
We shouldn't dwell too much on this thing that you've addressed in so many interviews, but just in the book, that the Achilles heel, that despite all this very precise drumming that you'd never actually had to play to a click track until David Foster stuff, is that right?
David put me under a click without announcing it, and I'd never played with a click, so it was an uncomfortable moment, to say the least. And plus, there were other things that went down that between David and I, and you know, listen, I brought David into the picture. It was my idea, and I pushed the band for him to produce us. I knew we needed somebody strong. So I don't ever regret bringing David into the, because we made great records with him. You know, David and I had a falling out for many years. Well, you know, we're not best of buddies, but you know, we've kind of cleaned it up, you know, acknowledged. I don't know if he intentionally meant to expose. That was an Achilles heel for me at the time. Not anymore, because I can play with a click now, but I'd never done it.
I guess I'm surprised, you know, as a technique thing, so many times, you know, the way that you learn to do paradiddles or something is turn on a metronome at 80 BPM or 60 BPM and do them slow. But you developed all that technique without going through those hoops.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's true. It just, I can't explain why. And I certainly studied with very accomplished teachers, but they felt my time was good enough and they never forced me to play with a click, with a metronome. So now I practice with a metronome, and I think it's good to practice with a click. I wouldn't want to have to play every night with a click, I'll tell you that. I would hate that. And that's what Chicago has to do now. They play with tracks. So they need a click. And that's, oof, I would hate that. Because you got to have that thing so loud in your ears to stay with it, especially in a live, even in the studio. It's like having a stick up your ass.
I will confess that I obnoxiously, the very first time I played on a stage in high school, I had written a thing with my guy who had a sequencer, and we made our drummer wear headphones and play to a click. There's no call for that kind of pretentiousness for a high school performance, to make your good drummer do that.
Was that in the 80s?
It was 88, yes.
Yeah, so in the 80s, I was, listen, drum machines and everything was so in vogue, and drum machines were so, you know, they looked like they were going to replace us. So we don't need to apologize for that. I mean, I had to do it too in a couple songs, and I hated it.
My favorite bands when I started songwriting were The Cars, that, you know, had Heartbeat City that was sequenced all to hell, and Chicago of that period, which was also very sequenced, and I had come out of orchestra. And so I really thought, my guitar teacher even said, oh yeah, Chicago, that's one of those bands. Everybody has their music in front of them and they read off it. And so it's everybody kind of has their part, but it sounds like for Devil Sweet, which you would think that would be the song where people would have to be reading off music to match these rhythms. You're saying that's not how it worked at all. It was a much more interactive, just organic growth.
Jimmy wrote the horn parts and voiced it. Uh-huh. They were definitely reading charts. And there were times, quite often, I was reading charts just to learn the song. But I wasn't a good enough reader where I could. I mean, there were times in my development early on, I was a good reader. But if you don't do it all the time, you lose it. You know, reading is, I haven't been disciplined enough to keep it up. But yeah, there was some reading at times, especially the horn players. And there were chord charts, but not on stage. By the time we hit stage, sometimes it was like the ballet, I was definitely reading sections. And there were horn parts I had to kick or you know, double. And so that would be read off a chart. And quite often, you know, there were some things Jimmy would, you know, say, hey, can you kick this? And I'd see the chart. It always feels better once you really learn it and it's memorized. There's a certain thing to reading and then learning it enough to where you memorize it, you live it.
Sure. But yeah, just getting it down in the first place. I've certainly been in bands where there were, you know, no pieces of paper involved except for getting the lyrics or basic chords. But then if you want to do the slightest bit of unison rhythmic subtlety at all, it's really hard to just nail it down and do that every time without having some kind of mini chart.
In my band, CTA, that I'm doing now, the keyboardist plays with quite a few other artists, and he needs charts. And the horn players, we have different horn sections because of the budgetary restrictions. We pick up horn sections in different regions, and then, you know, it saves a lot of money, airfares and quite often hotels. So they're always reading. But I do believe that, you know, people play better off of paper than they do on it. But, you know, it's kind of a necessary evil for some people.
I'm glad you brought that up because we're transitioning to our final thing. We're just going to introduce this and say goodbye. You can take as long as you want to introduce it. So the song I had picked off there was The Real World by California Transit Authority from Sacred Ground 2013. So you've done two albums with those folks, with Mark Bonilla. I know you had a lot of lineup changes even between those two albums and maybe the first one.
Full Circle.
Full Circle, yes.
Isn't that ironic? First album is called Full Circle and the second song has a song on it called Full Circle, which was supposed to be on the first album, but we didn't finish it on time.
And that Full Circle has a few more your versions of Chicago songs, whereas this one is more just original, new material. Can you say something about this? You've got four writers on this, Mark Bonilla, Mick Mahan.
Yeah, Mick Mahan was the original bass player in CTA.
Yeah, on bass, Ed Roth on keys. I was listening to solo stuff by Ed and Mark.
A wonderful keyboardist.
And is it Larry Bragg singing lead, is that right?
Yeah, Larry Bragg is singing lead, who was with Tower Power for 14 years and now is lead singing with the Temptations. Larry's all over our first two albums, a wonderful singer.
How does a four-person writing cooperative, how did this song come together that we're about to hear as compared to all the stuff back in time here?
When we got into Sacred Ground writing it, and Mark came up with the idea, and I think it's a great idea of all of us getting together and jamming and creating grooves and creating foundations for songs. And that's the result of Real World and the song Sacred Ground. And there's another song called Primetime. It's an instrumental that were really written on the spot. And with today's technology, with Pro Tools, he would record sections. Like, we really invented, Mark and I invented that odd time thing at the end. It's freaky odd time, you know? But I wanted to listen. Let's come up with something odd time that, but grooves. It just turns around, you know? You have to feel it. Trying to count it, you go nuts. So it was a great collaborative effort. Mark wrote the lyrics.
Does he chart out the horns? Is he kind of the band leader in terms of organizing, getting the pieces of paper to the horn players and stuff? Or is there yet another, you had other people in that?
He wrote the horns for almost all the songs except for Take Me Back to Chicago. It was Peter Fish, who was involved, very much involved in the first album, played the synth brass. And he's a dear, dear, close brother of mine from New York City, which is why he doesn't tour with the band and play with us full time, because he's in New York City. And he's, so Mark wrote the brass on everything but Strike While the Iron's Hot, Take Me Back to Chicago, and In the Kitchen, the Peter Fish composition and horn. And he's a brilliant horn arranger. That was the first time Mark had ever arranged brass. And I think he did a fabulous job on Full Circle. So, you know, CTA is now it's evolved into something even different. It's still, you know, Mark, myself, Ed Roth. Now we have Travis Davis, who really was in the band almost from the beginning. And Mick was so busy with Pat Benatar touring so much that he really couldn't do the CTA. So we brought in Travis Davis, who's a really fine bassist and singer. And now Bill Champlin. I called Bill Champlin, and we kind of mended fences after the Chicago debacle with me. And Bill and I hadn't spoke for 20 years, I think. And somehow or another, we made our way back to one another and mended fences. And so I had brought Bill in to sing Full Circle, because it was really about him and about why I left music and why I had to come back. And Bill did a beautiful job singing it. And he also did some backgrounds on the album that were just sacred ground. He did beautiful backgrounds on them. So now Bill pretty much performs with us full time. And we have another singer by the name of Tony Grant, who's just off the charts great. And, you know, we're doing a lot more Chicago material because that's what people really want. Occasionally we sprinkle in a couple of originals from the first, second album. But we're doing predominantly Chicago, and people love it. And so we're really kind of touring off of that base, because that's really what people want to hear us play. We do Chicago songs so well. We do them better than any tribute band, for sure, because we're not a tribute band. You got two guys from the original band, and you got these amazing world-class musicians. So, you know, that's CTA today. One of my goals in 2019 is to do a CTA album and to do the big band project with Peter Fish that we hear Peter and I started. There's some YouTubes of the big band with Will Lee. And now that Jason Scheff and I, one of the greatest things that came from the Hall of Fame performance with Chicago was Jason apologized to me for what his part in my firing has built in. We're really great friends now, play golf together, play some charity, a lot of charity events together. He sits, comes and sits in, and when we perform in L.A., people love, you know. So at some points, we have three former band members of Chicago in the band. And I think Jason, Bill, and I are talking about doing a project together. So in 2019, it's going to be an interesting, fun year for me, because I believe CTA is finally starting to get into recognition it deserves and the amount of work shows we deserve. And the big band project, Danny Serafin's Badass Rockin' Big Band, is going to, I think, get a shot. And at least we're going to make a great record. And then I want to make another record with CTA, and then the Bill Champlin, Danny Serafin, Jason Scheff project. It should be an exciting, creative year for me.
You're obviously a super verbal guy, just from talking to you and from the book. Any more lyrics going to come out of you, or are you just, that time's done?
You know, my wife asked me that, and she said, how come you don't write anymore? And I said, well, you know, I'm so buried in the business aspect of, you know, this is a different business than before. Before, you had a manager, publicist, record company. Unless you're making large amounts of money and selling, you know, you're not going to get a manager that's worth his weight. You know, so basically nowadays we do it all ourselves, and in the world that we operate in. And so I need to really start digging deep and writing lyrics again. But to be honest, I've been so preoccupied with getting the band booked, the business part of it, that it's kind of taken me away from that. So that's a good question. And thank you for putting me on the spot, because, you know, it's something that I need to do. And it's something that I certainly can do. I've proven that I can do it well. And you know, maybe Hawk and I, you know, it'd be great for Hawk and I to get together and do some writing. When we get together now, we play golf. But the answer to your question is I damn well better. But I wouldn't put it in writing that I'm going to do it. The last thing I co-wrote was Full Circle. which is a really, really great song, you know, and one that I'm very proud of. And is it ever going to get the recognition it deserves? I don't know. We don't. I think, you know, nowadays when we record, at least those of us of the elder statesmen from the 70s, we don't think about what market we're aiming for. I certainly don't relate to the new music. And I think a lot of it is that I'm old, and I remember what it was like to make music, you know, all together and without a click, without computers fixing this, everything. I hate all the perfection that's out there, because I think they've sterilized the shit out of music and taken a lot of the soul out of it. And I know that a lot of the young artists really long to be unshackled. I despise auto-tune in one sense. You know, I think it's overused. You know, I think it's a tool to kind of clean things up. It's good. And quantizing to a certain degree to make, you know, people have gotten so used to sterile perfect that when they hear something with some hair on it, I think it'll mean more.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. This is The Real World by California Transit Authority, Sacred Ground 2013. Have a great day.
You too, my friend. I've enjoyed this.
thanks so much to Danny. That was a very beefy interview. Chicago was a band whose 80s output infected my brain before my critical faculties had even taken hold. But I still like him now. It was great to talk to someone who was so instrumental in their more adventurous work. I do recommend his book. It was a very quick read. It's Street Player. And yeah, he really did grow up in gangs that were sort of two steps removed from organized crime. And of course, the rock and roll part is interesting too. Again, you can learn more about his current activities at DannySerafine.com. My next interview is another one I'm very excited about. Split Enz is a band that I have a long, long history with. And I got to talk to their founding genius, Phil Judd, speaking to me all the way from Australia. So come back for that. You can subscribe at NakedlyExaminedMusic.com. Or better yet, go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic, sign up as a supporter, and grab the ad-free feed from there. Hope you enjoyed it. I'd love if you go onto the iTunes store page for this podcast, leave a nice 5-star rating and review. You can follow me on Facebook or Twitter. Please share these interviews with interested folks. But most importantly, keep on musicking. This is Mark Linson-Wire signing off.